Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. With me in the studio, obviously you've heard this before, is my producer, Mr. Dan Arnfield. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hello.
It's good to have you here. We're all excited here in Oklahoma because the weather has finally cooled off. And I actually have my fall vest on, my sweater vest. It feels good. People are actually picking on me saying, what are you doing with your sweater vest on? I said, it's fall and it's cool out. It's great. So glad to be back here in the studio. And I'm really excited to let you know that I have a comment today. And actually, I received this comment a little while ago. And I just got distracted. We've been back into classes and we are now in midterms. It's just kind of insane right now, everything going on. Not only are the students going insane because of all the studying, but then they have to face their grades. And some of them are going to be happy. Some of them are not going to be happy. That's just the way it goes. I have one more midterm to execute. And I'm not executing anybody, but it's like you take your pen and you stick it in their finger or something. But anyway, the class is going to do really well with it, but another midterm on, Thursday this week. And then it's back to another class and then the weekend. So it's going to come fast. It just seems like life goes fast here. But this comment is from Lisa and Nathan, and I know them very well. I'm not going to tell you their last names, but they live down under. And if you don't know what that means, I'll explain it to you. They're from Australia, and they are favorite listeners. Lisa's the mom, Nathan is the son, and I think this is one of the greatest comments you could get. And he goes, hello, Mr. Leap. So he knows who I am. He knows my last name. He says, sorry, I haven't emailed you in a while. I've been very busy with my school work and reading lots of books. I am still reading The Famous Five, The Secret Seven, and I now have Treasure Island to look forward to. So this is a young reader, but he does listen to the JBL podcast. He says, I've had a good time in the holidays and I've just enjoyed listening to your podcast. So this was still during the summer holidays. And he said, I've been enjoyed listening to your podcast about the book Hero of the Empire. I said to my mom, can you please buy me that book? I also wanted to email you to tell you that I have eaten Winston Churchill's favorite cake that Mummy made, the Dundee cake. Well, he also sent me a picture of the Dundee cake, and I would like to try it. I would like to try the Dundee cake. It looks so good. He says, have you eaten it before? No, sorry. It's so yummy. Secret ingredient, Paddington Bear's marmalade. So he reads his books. I don't know. I've been on a lot of flights last year or so, and I have to admit that I watched Paddington Bear on the flights. You know, so he goes on to say, hope you have a great day and a good day. Love, Nathan from Down Under. So thank you, Nathan, for writing in. But thank you also for being such a good student and reading books. That's really great. It's so wonderful that you can do that. And if you don't get that book from your mom, drop me a line. I might find a way to get one for you. All right. Take care. So on our last program, I finished chapter 6 titled, We Have Now Gone Far Enough. Now, if you remember that chapter, and again, if you if time has passed and you forgot a little bit about it, you can go back and listen to that series anyway. In fact, you can listen to all the series. It goes back as far as the radio library is in existence. Anyway, remember now, Chapter 6 does give us the history of the settlement of the Boers in South Africa. And one of the things why that chapter is so important, what it does is it essentially shows us that the Boers became skilled fighters to maintain control of the land that they took possession of from the native Zulu and Xhosa tribes. Now, again, they became great fighters, but as time passed, the Boer Botha family helped the Zulu tribe defeat rivals of their own, and then a period of peace then prevailed between them and the other tribes, although every now and then there would be some rough days. Now, for today's podcast, I want to move on to Chapter 7. And Chapter 7 is a title that really gives away that things are not going well for the British. And that's essentially what this chapter is about. So remember now, the British believe they would have the easy fight against the Boers. They thought it's going to be really easy. And as I stated previously, the Boers were well prepared for the coming fight. And so again, this title is, the chapter 7 is titled Blackest of All Days. So let's begin on page 77 today. And we're going to move on to page 78, but then we're going to go back, slip back to page 73, 74, and you'll see why I'm doing that and as we get there. But on page 77 now, this is one of the things we have to remember when we get into Chapter 7 is Winston Churchill has not even made it to be on land yet in South Africa. And so this is a really kind of an interesting chapter. It says, on October 29th, the day before the Battle of Ladysmith, and if you remembered last podcast, Chapter 6 does cover the chapter, or does cover the Battle of Ladysmith. Now, on October 29th, the day of the Battle of Ladysmith, the passengers of the Dunnottar Castle, their long journey nearly over, sighted another vessel on the horizon. It was a large steamship, the Australian, or Australasian, I should say, heading away from South Africa with soldiers aboard and bearing, Churchill excitedly wrote, "Who should say what tidings?" Desperate for the news of war, the men rushed onto the decks, hanging over the railings with their telescopes, binoculars, and cameras, trained on the ship as the distance between them quickly closed. Even Buller, and remember, he's one of the leading soldiers there. He said even Buller stepped out onto the lower deck and peered at the ship through his field glasses. When the two ships came within 200 yards of each other, the men on the Australasian gave their fellow soldiers a raucous three-cheer salute. What happened next, however, sent an electric thrill of shock through the passengers of the Dunnottar Castle. It was, Atkins, the reporter for the Manchester Guardian, would later write, "the most dramatic encounter at sea that any of us could call to mind or was likely to experience again." And this was really shocking what happened. So as the ship passed by, the men on the decks, too far away to be heard, slid onto the ratlines, a long black board with words written on it in bright white chalk. It says, "Boers defeated, three battles, Penn Simmons killed." Now, if you know anything about Winston Churchill, he is really aggravated that he wasn't there. So he couldn't write anything about it. Remember now, this is his political move. He needs to get famous in this war so that he can get further ahead in politics. He says, "The men surrounding him, Churchill gasped and took a collective reeling step back from the bulwark. The fighting had already begun, and it had been fierce. Under heaven, Churchill wrote, we have held our own, but the shock of Penn Simmons' death reverberated throughout the ship. If the general who had no misfortunes in India, whose men, even as his rear guards, had always come safely into camp, had fallen to the Boers, how many more had shared this fate? So Penn Simmons was a famous general, and when they were in India, he always returned safely home. So, but he's dead. Penn Simmons was killed. He's dead. There were three battles, and supposedly the Boers were defeated. Now, Candace goes on to say, as the ship swiftly disappeared from sight, taking with it the answers to their many desperate questions, Churchill, never shy about making his opinion known, openly complained that it would have only taken 10 minutes to have stopped the ship and got proper information. So he's already torqued that he doesn't know the whole story. And I know Winston is not available to hear this today, but I'm going to tell the whole story, I think, in this podcast, what really happened. And if I don't get the whole story done, we got another podcast we can use for that. It goes on here, it says, we should know everything that happened quite soon enough. Churchill, however, although not even a soldier, let alone the commander-in-chief, remained impenitent and unconvinced. So he is not going to say, hey, I'm not staying out of this. We're going to find out about this. The next day, when the Dunnottar Castle arrived at Cape Town's Table Bay and waited to be pulled into the harbor, Churchill watched hungrily as a tugboat ran alongside the ship and a man stepped aboard. He was, in Churchill's words, not just any man, but a man who knew. It was the moment Churchill had been waiting for since leaving Southampton 2 weeks earlier, and he was determined to extract every last bit of information there was. And so we're on page 78 now, by the way. So Churchill is really going to go to work. Said Churchill was not alone in his impatience. Surrounded by nearly 300 soldiers and journalists, the man was practically chased across the old floorboards until he reached the ladder leading to the hurricane deck. Quickly climbing on the rungs, he chose a step halfway up and took a seat. Only then, with an odd quiver of excitement in his voice, did he finally tell his story. While his audience stood transfixed, the man described one battle after another that had already been fought between the Boers and the British. Every major battle but Ladysmith, which was taking place as he spoke. Finally, after listening to the tales of stubborn, well-fought fights with honor for both sides, triumph for neither, one man in the audience asked the question that was on all of their minds. Tell us about the losses, he said. Who are killed and wounded? Now, That's is an interesting thing there. And it goes on to say, or Candace goes on to say, it was a stunningly long list. Churchill would later remember a list of the best officers in the world. As the names of friends, mentors, fathers, and brothers were read out loud, the men who had gathered eagerly at the foot of the ladder began to turn one by one, hurry away, overcome with emotion they did not want their fellow soldiers to see. So this was really very upsetting when they heard that the war had started, there were three battles, and there was a lot of men dead. And so that was really, frustrating for them. But we're going to look at this a little bit deeper here in just a second. He said Churchill knew several of the men on the list, all lying under the stony soil or filling the hospitals at Pietermaritzburg and Durban, but one name in particular leaped out at him with a painful jolt of recognition, and that was Almer Haldane. Churchill had met Haldane the year before when he was trying to persuade Sir William Lockhart, then Commander-in-Chief of Her Majesty's Army in India, to let him fight on the northwest frontier. Haldane, who was Lockhart's aide-de-camp, had at first been none too cordial, Churchill remembered, but for a reason that Churchill could not quite understand, His attitude had abruptly and completely changed. I don't remember what I said or how I stated my case, Churchill later wrote, but I must have hit the bullseye more than once. For after about a half an hour's walking up and down on the gravel path, Captain Haldane said, "Well, I'll go and ask the commander-in-chief and see what he says." So if you remember back in history, we've been talking about Churchill. He was always looking for a new plan. He was always looking for a new event. And this Captain Haldane had helped him find something. So anyway, we're not going to spend a lot of time with Haldane. But I want to go back now to page 73 and 74 to give you a clear explanation of why Penn Simmons died. And the thing is, I want to do for all of you listening is I want to just remind you that the Boers were really committed to their cause. They really wanted to win this war. And the British were really quite, well, laissez-faire about it. They just felt they were so good, so bold, so big, so bad, that they were going to beat these little Boers. And it turns out the Boers weren't so little. So let's go back just briefly now to page 73 and page 73 and 74. And I can show you why Penn Simmons died. And it's really, you know, it's really something that we have to learn about the British, that, you know, that sometimes they were too arrogant. This is the page 73. It's the next to the last paragraph down. It says, "In Natal, Penn Simmons and his counterpart, General George White," and we talked about George White before last time, and we'll talk about him again in a minute, just to remind you, "were equally unconcerned about the tens of thousands of burghers surrounding them from nearly every direction, and had decided to divide their already woefully inadequate force. Of their roughly 12,000 men, some 8,000 had gone northwest, where to the British garrison town of Ladysmith, with White and the other 4,000 further north with Penn Simmons in Dundee. Both towns were beyond the curving Tugela River, which Buller had repeatedly warned them not to cross until he arrived." And so they were given some directions, and you know, did they pay attention? Did they listen? And they were warned not to cross. Now it goes on. Now remember, now we're talking about Penn Simmons, and then we'll talk a little bit more about George White. "By the time he reached Ladysmith, White, taking in the stark terrain and the tension that seethed in every town he passed, had quickly realized that he had made a serious mistake." And I had talked to you about that last time. He finally realized his arrogance didn't get him very far. And he had made a very serious mistake. Well, so did Penn Simmons. And we're going to see this here in a second. It says, "Goodbye, dear." This is White writing to his wife. "Goodbye, dear old lady." He had written miserably to his wife, "We should have 20,000 more troops in South Africa than we have." Penn Simmons, however, continued to insist that there was no cause for concern, confidently marched his small brigade even further north than Ladysmith to Dundee, where he planned to set up camp. Now, again, here's the arrogance, and this is Penn Simmons. He had a lot of it. And the next paragraph down, this is page 74, it says, "In Dundee, Penn Simmons ran his brigade much as he had in India. He hosted great nights in the regimental mess so that his officers might bring their wives, encourage his men to wear their scarlet and green dress uniforms, and cheerfully discuss plans for Christmas dinner in Pretoria." All right, that is totally British. The war is already going badly for them. And remember now, the Boers are tough people. Tough, tough people. And he goes on to say, or I should say Candace goes on to say, "Even as his scouts warned him that the Boers had begun to descend upon Dundee, Penn Simmons scoffed that no Boer commando would dare to attack a British brigade, no matter its size. I feel perfectly safe, he coolly told the agitated officers under his command. I am dead against retreating. All right. You got to begin to think. What was he thinking? At 5 o'clock on the morning of October 20th, after a night of rain so heavy, the British were certain it would deter any man, even the Boers, from scaling the hills surrounding their camp. A shell suddenly rent the quiet morning air. Penn Simmons was just about to sit down to his breakfast when the second shell thundered down in the midst of his tents, missing his own by only a few yards. Outraged by the Boers' impudence, he smoked a cigarette as he began issuing orders, commanding his men to train their guns on Talana Hill. So he didn't even get all excited. He was just smoking, eating his breakfast, giving commands. And but he didn't realize Botha was right on the other side. He was on the other side. He said, for Botha and his commando, watching from the same hill on which Penn Simmons had set his sights, the entire British brigade, racing from tent to tent, scrambling to respond to the attack, made a stunningly easy target. No man among them, however, was more conspicuous than Penn Simmons himself, who insisted that his aide-de-camp ride by his side, holding a dashing scarlet pennant. Within minutes, nearly every inch of ground surrounding the camp was, in the words of one British soldier, literally rising in dust from the bullets, and the din echoing between the hill and the wood below and among the rocks from the incessant fire of the Mausers seemed to blend with every other sound into a long, drawn-out, hideous roar. It's in the midst of the onslaught, Ben Simmons refused to find cover or take even the slightest precaution. Can you believe this guy? Angrily climbing over a low wall that was impeding his forces' progress, he disappeared from sight, making his way over ground that was littered with the bodies of his men. Minutes later, he returned to his aide-de-camp, his face strained and pale, and tersely informed him that he had been shot in the stomach and was severely, mortally wounded. And so here's why Penn Simmons died, because he was arrogant. And he believed that the Boers were easily pushed around. The Boers, who had only 3 artillery guns to Penn Simmons' 18, could not sustain the attack and were finally forced to retreat. But they had accomplished what they had come to do, shatter their enemies' confidence. So really, Penn Simmons should have won. But he was too arrogant to take them on. And, you know, they didn't have as much firepower as the British did, but they knew how to shatter their enemies' confidence. That's what was critical in the war. As Botha's commandos disappeared in the distance, a veil of rain obscuring their tracks on the muddy veld, they left behind more than 500 British casualties, and among them Penn Simmons, who lay dying in a hospital tent while his second-in-command, Brigadier General James Rule, hastily ordered his brigade, to pack up what they could and flee southward toward Ladysmith. 2 days later, a Boer commander, taking possession of Dundee, would find Penn Simmons dead and stand watching hat in hand as the fallen officer's body was sewn into a British flag and buried into the yard of a local English church. And so that was the end of Penn Simmons. And, it's really sad to see anybody die, but it's even more sad to see someone die because of their own arrogance. It says, on October 26, nearly a week after the Battle of Talana Hill, Ewell and his 5,000 men finally reached Ladysmith. Following an exhausting and harrowing journey, they quickly learned, however, that they had hardly outmaneuvered the Boers. Not only had the British lost another 300 men wounded and dead in the Battle of Elandslaagte, I guess that's how you say it, Elandslaagte, I can't say it. You'll just have to read it yourself. less than 20 miles away, but George White's regiment was also completely surrounded. Worse, the Boer force deploying around Ladysmith was not 8,000 strong, but it was 20,000 strong. Now, we know George White and Ben Simmons said, it's going to be easy. We're not going to have any trouble. We're going to beat the pants off the Boers. Didn't happen. As he had been in Dundee, Louis Botha was situated on a prominent hill overlooking Ladysmith, ready for the battle to begin. This time, however, the order to fire would come from the commando's leader, his old friend and mentor, Louis Meyer, but from Botha himself. So, in other words, Louis Botha, is being elevated. He's being honored because they're beating the pants off the British. And so he got to give the charge. And he goes on to say, Lucas Meyer, his old friend and mentor, Lucas Meyer, but from Botha himself. So Lucas Meyer was really one of the commanders that I don't think he was necessarily over Botha, but they were good friends. But he was always the one leading the charge. So soon after reaching Ladysmith, Meyer had fallen ill, and Botha had quickly been chosen to take command, making him the youngest Boer commander in the war. He had already won confidence all around by the clearness of his views and the intrepidity of his actions. So the Irish journalist and activist Michael David, who covered the Boers during the war, wrote of Botha, and his promotion to the command in question became exceedingly popular, especially among the younger and the more ardent Boers. And so here we have a situation where Candace Millard is really giving us a really good point of view, is that the British wasted their opportunity with the Boers. They wasted it. And they were so arrogant. And of course, you know, that again, that's going a little bit backwards. But that's all the time we have for today's program. Now, in our next program, we will continue to discuss Candace Millard's book, Hero of the Empires, Part 2, Into Africa, Chapter 7. And I promise you, now we're getting closer. We will finally stand on the battlefield with the British and the Boers and our hero, Winston Churchill. Now, this book is a wonderful supplement to Winston Churchill's book, My Early Life, and continues the history of Winston's success in politics and the Boer War. Now, you can find a new or used copy of Millard's book at Amazon.com. And of course, you may be able to find one in your local bookstore. And of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And I also want to say to all the Facebook favorites out there, the people that are following me through Facebook, thank you for all your comments. There's a lot of comments out there. So until next time, keep reading.
Been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.